Hi, my name is Desi Rankin. Tune in to the Sunday show between the hours of 10 and 12 with a bit of soca and a bit of reggae and a bit of lovers rock and some revival. Just tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12. In the meantime,
the Desi Rankin show on BCFM.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. With French company Atos being paid to punish and bully disabled people, just what does Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith think he's up to? Plus, the marketisation at Bristol University as courses drift away from being designed for individual students and become more and more tailored to the wishes of rich and powerful corporations. We speak to one of the editors of the university newspaper, Epigram. Brother and the Drones, Trapwire and Riot. No, they're not the latest rock bands, but technocrats' surveillance technology arriving faster than you can blink and without you being asked. Is that democracy? And who watches the watchers? Well, Steve Jolly's who, and he'll be bringing us up to date with the Orwellian state later in the show. Also, myths of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Did God give the Holy Land to Benjamin Netanyahu and the present state of Israel? The son of an Israeli general begs to differ. Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, which is where we start, Martin. And one of the hotspots is actually in Horsham in Sussex later on, a couple of weeks' time, not in another part of the world. But this is a court case which is before a judge at Horsham on Monday, February the 25th. Someone who's refusing to pay his TV licence fee on the grounds that by suppressing the truth about the 9/11 attacks, the BBC is aiding and abetting terrorism.
Yes, I mean, and the organisation I'm associated with, Reinvestigate 9/11, are associated with this as well. This is the first time a British courtroom has agreed to listen to the evidence. But, of course, people may or may not be aware that the Italian Supreme Court have sent a, I don't know what, an affidavit or something to the International Criminal Court concerning 9/11. And, of course, in Italy, with the bombings in Bologna Railway Station, the assassination of Aldo Moro, Operation Gladio in the 1970s and 80s, they're very well aware of the illegal and terroristic behaviour of the security services. People in Britain are less aware, but this court case may bring some of it to light.
Well, it's taking place Monday, 25th of February at Magistrates Court in Horsham, West Sussex, in front of a judge. Expert witnesses are attending, including chemist Niels Harrit. Now, why would a chemist come along to attend as an expert witness to do with 9/11?
Because Niels Harrit is from Copenhagen University, and he has had peer-reviewed in scientific journals his discovery of nanothermite in the dust from the World Trade Center attacks.
So what is nanothermite, and why does it matter?
Very high-level military explosive, which implies, of course, that the buildings were blown up.
Well, I mean, you know, surely Al-Qaeda could have got all of this military
explosive. Maybe so,
explosives.
But that's not what the government's been saying for the last 15 years.
OK, and also author Ian Henshaw will testify on the BBC's repeated and palpably false claim the 9/11 sceptic case has been adequately investigated. What does he mean by that?
What he means by that is that the BBC have been complicit in basically misleading the public about aspects of the attack. So, for example, just one example, on the day of the attack, a BBC journalist was seen speaking to cameras, saying that Building 7, the third building that collapsed, because three buildings collapsed, had already collapsed, even though in shot behind her, the building was still standing. So, in other words, she'd been told by presumably some security official that Building 7 had collapsed. It did collapse soon thereafter, but while she was speaking, it was actually in shot behind her shoulder. Now, in other words, the BBC haven't fulfilled their licence mandate to report objectively about what happened. And of course, people in Italy, after things that they went through in the 70s and the 80s, they're very well aware that the media is part of the psychological war game. But of course, you know, there are some very serious witnesses, including US architects and engineers, who will be appearing in this British Magistrates Court on that day. They've got 3 hours to make their case.
And it's all being conducted under the Section 15, Article 3 of the Terrorism Act 2000. They're saying that actually the BBC are terrorists for aiding and abetting a terrorist attack.
Yeah, I mean, it's using the law to try and get to the bottom of things. Ultimately, that is the way to go forward. If there were elements in the intelligence services who were either complicit or basically responsible for these attacks, the way to deal with them is to get them arrested.
Before we go totally off the subject of the BBC, a very different part of the BBC to these people being accused here are on strike on Monday. The entire BBC is on strike over a dispute to do with pensions and pay and conditions, which has been long running. And anyone that like to support the union workers at the BBC can go down to White Ladies Road and support them from 8 a.m. on Monday morning. So that strike is on, unless I imagine there's some sort of last minute settlement over the weekend, which I very much doubt. There will be no BBC on Monday.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Another story. North Korea has confirmed, Martin, its third nuclear test this week. Now, this is a bit worrying too, isn't it? The North Koreans with nuclear weapons. I mean, it's a bad idea, isn't it, to have more and more countries being added to the nuclear club.
Well, yes, and of course, previously they've exploded one uranium-based bomb and one plutonium-based bomb, which, if you think about it, is rather odd. The Pakistanis developed uranium-based nuclear weapons through AQ Khan, but the North Koreans apparently have access to plutonium.
Sorry, through what?
AQ Khan was the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, but he'd worked in Holland in the civil nuclear industry. So they went the uranium route to developing their bomb. North Korea seems to have both uranium and plutonium, and it's going to be interesting to see whether it's a uranium bomb or a plutonium bomb, because of course we're getting inside information on this show and elsewhere about where these the source of this uranium and plutonium. The plutonium is sourced by the US is losing several plutonium-based bombs in the 1991 war off the coast of Somalia, and then them being retrieved by Rhodesian-based mercenaries.
Now, these bombs apparently were on a B-52 bomber and had to be ditched because the bomber actually caught fire. So, obviously, if you've got nukes on board, you've got to get rid of those nukes before you crash.
Yeah, and the source we're getting this from was involved, you know, basically involved in arms to South Africa for many years. This is the source that the information that we're getting. And also, of course, South Africa's nuclear weapons were bought by a consortium of Tory grandees and resold to the British government at a profit to themselves and to the Tory party, and then they lost the nuclear weapons because they were dealing with criminals who basically double-crossed them. But these criminals are essentially South Africans, Rhodesian-based mercenary groups who've got tentacles to the highest levels in this country. If people are interested in this story, they should check out Veterans Today, Gordon Duff in the United States, or Peter Eyre.
That's right. Peter Eyre blog is rather good. And the actual post is a couple of years old, but it's got all the details in there. It's called Britain and the United States Lost Three Nuclear Weapons Each. So the implication here is that the North Koreans have managed to get hold of this nuclear material because of blundering by the NATO countries.
Well, not just blundering, that was also profiteering. The whole point of the South African story was that the South Africans wanted to sell their nuclear weapons to the Western powers to get rid of them. And a group called Astra Holdings was set up, headed by a former MI6 officer called Stephen Koch, who interposed themselves into the deal, and basically they bought for a certain price the three nuclear weapons from Arms Corps, and then sold them onto the British government for £50 million at a profit to themselves and to the Conservative Party, £17.8 million to the Conservative
Party. I would stress that is an allegation.
It is in Hansard, where the Labour MP Doug Hoyle in fact asks the then Tory government where they'd got that money from, and they didn't have an answer. Now, this is information that we're getting from inside sources, and if people want to follow the story up, they should look at Gordon Duff's articles in Veterans Today, or alternatively go to Peter Eyre's people off.
Peter Eyre is spelled E-Y-R-E. Yeah. The other thing is, there is a precedent for this, isn't there? Because the second bomb at Nagasaki, it's documented now that much of the nuclear material from that, I think, is enriched uranium, from memory, actually came from the Nazis, because the Nazis had been enriching uranium. And at the end of World War II, in Europe, when the war finished in Europe, that enriched uranium was shipped over to the US, or in fact, shipped over to South America, and then incorporated into the US supply of nuclear material to build bombs with. So, I mean, you know, I suppose what we're saying there is that maybe that second bomb would never have happened if it hadn't been that the Americans getting their hands on the Nazi uranium.
Well, as you know, Roger Cook from the Cook Report managed to buy himself a warhead in the former Soviet Union.
Well, he didn't actually buy it.
No, he grasped it up to the authorities. But the fact is that there is an awful lot of nuclear material out there, and a lot of it, there's a black market in it. And of course, senior Western politicians and security services are involved in this black market. You know, people are as they are. Criminality is everywhere.
And if anyone wants to follow up that story to do with the enriched uranium from the Nazis at the end of World War II, there's a very good book all about it, written by Carter Heydrich.
News, weather, travel on BCFM's Drive Time.
Yes, and then our next story, jihadists are using Syria as a drill for British attacks, claims William Hague, Martin.
Well, this is rather strange because all this time we've been told that the rebels in Syria are freedom fighters and all the rest of it, and it actually turns out now they're noticing that they seem to be actually jihadist terrorists. But then, of course, jihadist terrorists have been working with NATO for a very long time. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who were the cutting edge of the rebellion in Benghazi, have been working with MI6 since the 1980s. And that, if people are surprised by that, they shouldn't be. Basically, jihadi groups have been working with the Western intelligence services all along, and of course they are used to undermine genuine Islamist movements, for example, like Hamas or Hezbollah. So this tactic has been going on for a very long time. But in Syria, I'm afraid, a terrible situation is developing where everybody is in the wrong and everybody's killing everybody else.
So where's it all going?
Well, who knows? I mean, the kind of jihadi terrorists that are operating in Syria and being called freedom fighters are operating in Iraq and being called terrorists, and they're pretty much the same people.
But the poor people of Syria are having to suffer all this. But is it going to draw in the US, the NATO forces, and the Russians, and possibly the Chinese?
The poor people of Iraq are still suffering 10 years after the demonstration, the big anti-war demonstration. Was the 10th anniversary today, and of course bombs are going off in Iraq all the time in Shia mosques planted by Sunni extremists, who are the same kind of people who are planting bombs in Syria. And unfortunately, that's the result of basically violence breeds violence, and we're now really reaping the whirlwind of those poor decisions that were made 10 years ago.
The Arab League actually said, didn't they, when the war started against Iraq, that this could open the gates of hell.
That's right, and it has, but of course we've all got used to it since then. We were horrified and shocked in 2003 by the brazen stupidity of it all, but people have now, eventually, they've got their own troubles, the banks have collapsed, people are worried for their jobs, and of course people are not noticing how bad the situation is getting out there.
Yes, bomb attacks aren't news anymore because they're so regular.
There's so many bomb attacks that hardly anybody notices, that's right.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Our final international story this week is NASA alert. Middle East is losing fresh water. Another grim Middle Eastern story, I'm afraid. Reserves the size of the Dead Sea in 7 years. The Middle East headed towards a water shortage crisis. NASA satellites have shown that the reserves the size of the Dead Sea have been depleted in just 7 years, largely due to well drilling. Newly obtained results show that 144 cubic kilometres of fresh water, a volume nearly equivalent to that to the Dead Sea or Lake Tahoe, had been removed from the ground in the area that encompasses Turkey from Iraq, Iran and Syria between 2003 and 2009. Looks like we've got a water crisis coming in the place that needs it most, Martin.
Yep, and I think all of these things do not bode well, do they? I mean, Turkey built a couple of big dams on the Euphrates and the Tigris a few years ago, which of course then meant Iraq didn't get the water it was expecting. And
This is the point, isn't it? Turkey's territory houses, as it says in this article on Russia Today, the headwaters of the region's two major rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, enjoys a strained relationship with Syria and Iraq, countries further downstream, has systematically diverted water for its own irrigation, which is frequently inefficient throughout the Middle East. So, in a way, the Turks are kind of slowly turning off the tap, aren't they?
Well, also, and the Israelis, of course, would like to seize the Litani River so that they could ensure their water supply. And they are, you know, they're taking aquifers in the West Bank, which from under Palestinian villages. I mean, really, fighting over resources and minerals and water, we are really on the edge of doing some really stupid things to ourselves if we don't have a word with ourselves and step back from the brink.
Or have a word with the Prime Minister of Turkey.
Well, all these things have to be properly negotiated. I mean, that's what it's talk or kill or both, isn't it?
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, with Tory Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan-Smith's curious decision to make the disabled pay for the greed of the banksters, the bullying and abuse of disabled people is reaching some pretty miserable proportions. But this week, some good news, and to share that with us is Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will. Welcome to Drive Time. Can you just tell us about the sort of nuts and bolts of this case with this disabled chap, Dan Glue?
Well, yeah, I mean, the details people can read about on the in the Post or on the This Is Bristol website. My focus is on a whole issue around ATOS failing to provide information to the people who use their services, which in this case are disabled and sick claimants, in an accessible way. It's not an isolated case, the one that was in the paper and the success that we read about this week. This is affecting lots of people all across the country, particularly people who've got sight problems in this case, because ATOS, unlike electricity companies, banks, building societies, they don't have a problem with sending people information in a format that they can read. But ATOS, and it isn't just ATOS, it's also the Job Centre and the Department of Works and Pensions, simply do not do that. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission have been trying to get the benefits side of it sorted out with the Department of Works and Pensions for years, and they're just not getting anywhere. ATOS have taken on that role. They've taken a contract. They've been paid millions of pounds to produce this contract, and they're not complying with the simple regulations that are set out in the Equality Act to enable disabled people to access their services. Whether they want to access those services, of course, is another question.
ATOS was paid £112.4 million of our taxpayers' money to carry out 738,000 assessments in 2011 and 2012. They've chosen not to comment on Mr. Glue's case. I would have thought that they could, pay someone to make comments on these sort of things. Why don't they comment?
I think you'd have to ask them, but they're not going to comment, no. But, I mean, £124 million is an awful lot of money, and you'd have thought out of that you'd be able to find a few bob to be able to produce a letter in large print format, which, of course, is all that claimants like Mr. Glue are asking for. And it also begs the question why they just can't do that for everybody in the first place so that there wouldn't be a problem. But, I mean, I don't know whether anybody's ever seen the letters they send out. They're very difficult to read. They're very small print, printed not on nice white paper that you can read so you can see the print, but they're printed for some strange reason on grey paper. So that makes them even more difficult to read. And people with sight who have sight problems have enormous difficulties. And Mr. Glue is not the only one.
I mean, my personal knowledge of people who've had these ATOS assessments is pretty grim. For example, coming back with a statement by a nurse when apparently they were supposed to go and see a doctor in the first place, but it's somebody else who calls themselves a nurse, that is actually nothing to do with the things that they'd have had discussed at the interview. So how do people know, not just disabled, but other people, you know, maybe who aren't quite so fully disabled, how do they know whether they have a chance to actually appeal, or even, as in this case, to essentially to sue them and to get compensation of some sort? In this case, Mr. Dan Glue has got £1,000.
Yeah, well, they need to get advice. They need to get good quality legal advice, which they can get by going to a local advice agency. But I mean, often you need to take legal action, and the place to come to there Obviously, I would say, is the Avon and Bristol Law Centre down on Stokes Croft.
Now, you're at the very bottom of Stokes Cross, just on the right-hand side, as you, if you're coming under the sort of bridge, 5102 bridge thing, you're just on the right-hand side there. But, I mean, you know, surely much of this kind of legal aid and help for people in situations like this has been withdrawn. I mean, we've heard over the last 18 months that much of legal aid is just no longer there.
Legal aid has been withdrawn. I mean, this particular case that we're talking about was funded by a fixed fee legal aid scheme, which is coming to an end at the end of this month.
So if this was to have happened to him next year, he wouldn't have actually been able to, unless he'd been able to fund it out of his own pocket. Now, obviously, he probably hasn't got the money to do that. He may not have even been able to take this case for this particularly horrific case of abuse by ATOS.
Well, it's a bit of a postcode lottery. Because he lives in Bristol and he's got a postcode in Bristol, he would still be able to come to the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. We have been able to replace the funding that we take these kinds of discrimination cases under with funding from Bristol City Council, who are funding now a unique project. In fact, it's the only one over the whole country, which is to offer legal advice and support in any kind of discrimination cases. This is a project that's going to run for 3 years. Now, if he lived in, say, Birmingham, for example, he wouldn't be able to access those services. Birmingham Law Centre, who probably would have been able to help under a legal aid funding, similar fixed fee scheme, are under threat of closure at the moment because their funding position is very, very precarious indeed. So it depends on where you live.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'm going to bring you in at this point because, I mean, this just isn't good enough, is it? A postcode lottery now for legal aid if you're a disabled person or in any other way being abused by ATOS or somebody else in a similar kind of these private businesses, which is sort of arm's length from the government, you know, basically breaking the law.
Yes, and from an economic point of view, you just think, what a waste of money all this is. Really, we're supposed to be saving money, but as we know, ATOS, 40% of people appeal and overturn the initial assessment, so 60% go through. When they've gone through, what have you done? You've moved them from sickness benefits to JSA, which is, again, more benefit. And the attempt to reform the system by introducing more and more difficulties. I mean, what you really should have is a system which gets the decision right the first time. That's the cheap way to do it. Yep. So we should have appeals and all the rest of it. Appeals should be there, but people shouldn't need to appeal, because if you're doing it right, you get the decision.
But the whole
right
point of this
time.
Is ATOS are basically being paid to reduce the benefit bill, aren't they?
That's right. But of course, they're reducing the benefit bill at the expense of the people they're dealing with. But of course, they're pushing the benefit bill up with the money that they're taking out of the pot to do that.
But those people,
so in other words, ATOS are taking the money literally out of the mouths of the people that they are assessing.
But the point being here is that they're trying to sort of chase people who are disabled to get jobs, and also people who are on JSA and other things. All these people have got to get jobs, and that will help the economy.
Well, yes, but in actual fact, they're not getting jobs, so all we're doing is shuffling the decks on the Titanic, and at the same time, we're throwing money down the drain. I mean, in actual fact, this is going to come home to roost when Britain probably loses its AAA credit rating later in the year, which is what all of this is supposedly about. We're supposed to be doing all of this to keep our AAA credit rating, but we're going to lose it because, in actual fact, they don't understand how the benefit system works. And because they don't understand it, they then give instructions for things to happen, which basically as has been pointed out, if you're going to deal with disabled people, you've got to make your material user-friendly, and they haven't even done that.
Well, one of the reasons
how completely incompetent they are.
One of the reasons people don't know how the benefit system works is because it keeps changing, and it's changing again this year with the introduction of something called the Universal Credit, which is supposedly one single payment into your bank account rather than various different benefits. It may be simpler, it may be more complicated, because of course there will be all sorts of aspects to this Universal Credit. And another thing, which of course has been talked about quite a bit recently, Will Stone from Avon Bristol Law Centre, is this bedroom tax. Are you finding that people are coming to you wondering whether they have to pay this tax, how they can maybe get a lodger in when they're being told by their landlord that they're not allowed to sublet, this kind of thing? Those are all sorts of, there's all sorts of, you know, things that people are having to wonder, which side am I on here? And I guess that's the sort of thing you can help with.
We can, yeah. It will we will have to see how it affects people in the Bristol area. I know the Bristol City Council have written to all of the all of their particular tenants who are being affected. So that's thousands they've identified and written to and said, look, this is how much you're going to lose. There are discretionary top-up payments. We don't know at this stage whether those payments are going to be made or how they're going to be implemented. So it just remains to be seen. But I think that we can say with some certainty that there will be people who will be at a very clear, strong risk of losing their homes and being evicted because they won't be able to afford to make the top-up payments for their rent, at which point they will then come to us. We will, at the Law Centre, we can advise people on eviction proceedings, we can defend eviction proceedings, and we successfully have been doing that for a large number of years. But ultimately, it's going to be up to the judges to see how the judges deal with it. There's probably going to be very little defence if you just can't afford to pay your rent.
Martin, this is a pretty grim situation because, as we've seen in many other parts of the country, there simply aren't enough one-bed flats to go around. If someone's living in a two-bed flat, they're being told, you're going to be evicted, where are they going to go?
Well, that's a good question. Well, they're probably going to go either to Avon Bristol Law Centre, which means they'll be accessing, you know, government support or of one kind or another, or they're going to be put in bed and breakfast and so on. I mean, it's literally going out of your way to make people feel insecure. And the idea of having a universal credit, to my mind, ought to be to make people feel secure in their circumstances so that they can then make life choices which are sensible for them. But in actual fact, what's going on is that we are actually making the people at the bottom, the people at the margin, feel more and more insecure, which of course then increases mental illness problems and so on. I don't think any of this is going to save a single penny. And that's the real, I mean, leaving aside the unfairness of it all, just look how stupid it all is.
Will, what about people if they're told that they have to move out of a two-bedroom house, they're in that sort of situation? The funny thing is, of course, that if they're in social housing, a one-bedroom flat in private rented housing actually can cost more.
That's right, and Housing Benefit will have to meet those top-up payments, so it's probably not going to save money in the long run. It's just going to cause an awful lot of stress and unnecessary anxiety for the people who've been living in their Bristol City Council flat for 20, 30, 40 years, and they suddenly find that they have to go out and find a much lower quality accommodation, perhaps in a bedsit.
I mean, isn't the simplest option to rent out your room to a lodger? I mean, and do you know, I mean, how, is that generally acceptable to social landlords like the City Council and to the housing associations?
Well, you need permission to do it. You also need to find somebody. And if you've got perhaps, you know, an elderly person who's living alone and has been living alone for some time, do they really want a stranger to come in? How are those people going to be vetted to ensure that they're an appropriate person to be living with that elderly person? I think there are all sorts of problems which really haven't been addressed by the government on this one.
Martin, I'll leave the final word to you. Ultimately, it looks like there's going to be big upheaval as all this starts to kick in, the bedroom tax and the universal credit, the latter part of this year. There's also, I can't even remember what it's called, but it's an IT system which is being brought in for employers where they have to supply minute-by-minute information to the Inland Revenue about what every single one of their employees is earning. At the end of this year, I suppose we'll know if this is all going to work or not, but ultimately... with the benefit changes particularly, how is this actually going to affect people out there?
Well, I suspect that we may have a perfect storm of a banking collapse followed by an attempted reform of the benefit system in the middle of a banking collapse, and it's going to cause social disruption on an enormous scale. And hopefully out of that will come the changes we need, the removal of the people in charge who don't seem to know what they're doing.
Well, the problem is, of course, that many of the people who are going to be at the butt end of this are the people who are most vulnerable. Anyway, Will, at least you're still there, even if the Birmingham place closes down. Just remind us where you are and when you're open.
Well, we're at the bottom of Stokes Croft. People can find out more about us by going onto our website, www.ablc.org.uk, ablc.org.uk, or they can ring us on 0116 07924 8226.
And when are you open? What are your opening hours?
Well, we're open Monday to Friday. We're open basically all day on Monday, Tuesday and Thursday, and mornings only on Wednesdays and Fridays. But you can contact us direct. All the details is emails. You can contact us by email.
If you're on the internet.
Telephone. If you're on the internet. If not, you can...
If you haven't been cut off the internet.
you can telephone us, or you can just drop in during those times that we're actually open and are building on Stokes Croft.
Okay, Will Stone, congratulations on helping that disabled chap. And you are from Bristol and Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, I'm joined now by Zaki Dogliani. Have I pronounced that right, Zaki?
That'll do. Dogliani is official. Official Italian pronunciation, but I've heard far worse over the years.
Okay, so you're forgiven. I didn't do too badly then. Now, you're up at the University of Bristol magazine Epigram. Tell us a little bit about the newspaper.
Yeah, Epigram's the independent student newspaper at Bristol University. It was founded in, I think, 1987 by James Landale, who's now deputy political editor of the BBC. It's the only print paper that you'll find on campus. There are some other newspapers start to emerge on the web. We've also got a website, epigram.org.uk. I get the plug in earlier, nice and early. But yeah, I'm the deputy editor of the news section, which report on stories affecting students, local community sometimes. The paper comes out fortnightly, but the website, obviously, and the Twitter feed we update more regularly than that.
Okay. Now, you have got a story this week, I notice. The Director of Sport, Exercise and Health at the university sent a secret email, naughty boy or girl, round to the captains of Focus Sports clubs, urging them to vote down a motion at the Students' Union AGM, which is aimed at making sport more accessible. Now, hang on a minute, because this sounds like you're trying to stop discrimination, and the Director of Sport, Exercise and Health is trying to actually stop it. In other words, he's actually being a little bit naughty, isn't he?
Well, it's an unprecedented thing that's happened. I mean, it hasn't happened quite a long time. A member of the university's senior staff trying to intervene with Students' Union AGM, the biggest student democratic event of the year, to try and influence the way that people act at the AGM voted. And as you said, he sent this email a couple of days before the AGM to the captains of the Focus Sports clubs, which are the 20 high-performance sports clubs. Overall, there are 53, but these 20 sports clubs are eligible for additional funding so they can compete at the top level, funding which can professional coaching, that kind of stuff. But the controversy dates back to when we reported in November about, maybe October, late October, when the university partially reinstated, the pay-as-you-go system for sports facilities. At the start of this academic year, they announced scrapping the pay-as-you-go system, which basically allows any student to use sports facilities, so it could be rugby pitches, sports hall, whatever, on a pay-as-you-go basis. So you pay, I don't know, fiver, tenner, you can use stuff. But they decided to get rid of this so that students to use facilities would have to pay for a pass, which would be about £250. And as you can imagine, this puts off a lot of casual users of sports facilities who want to do it for exercise purposes, for example, just want to do it for a bit of fun, who don't want to do it at a high performance level.
Okay. And also the monitoring, I know one of the other things you've brought up is the monitoring of international students. Now that sounds a little bit sinister, but hang on a minute, because the UK border agency have to keep an eye on, make sure that people are actually legally in the country. You know, they can be a student, but they may actually not be here legally.
I mean, it's true that there are what people call bogus colleges around the country, and I accept that they exist. But it's just the way that the university has gone about enforcing these checks, which they don't actually have to pass this stuff on to UKBA, UK Border Agency. And senior staff have claimed it's for the purposes of welfare, you know, of making sure these international students are okay. But several of the international students who we've interviewed have expressed concern about the relationship that it creates between them and the university. You know, they feel that they're treated as threats who need monitoring because they come from abroad. I mean, one, for example, said that the university told us that the university should have no role in reinforcing xenophobic views held by UKBA. If anything, it should be working to overcome them. And there's real kind of unrest among some international students. There's a petition that's drawn quite a lot of signatures about the way that they feel treated. And yeah, there's a story that the protest about it that we reported on before Christmas, this petition got sent off to the Vice Chancellor, I think, about a week ago, and will be raised at the next meeting of University Senate, which I believe is on the 25th of February.
Okay, now I suppose the big point though that you brought up when we were having a chat before you came on here was to do with the marketisation at the university. Now I think this is happening right across society. It's not just Bristol University that's having to put up with it, but what is the actual effect? I mean, when you say marketisation, we all kind of know what that means. That is that something which was fairly regulated, government funded, is starting to be more and more funded by private business, by private industry, and then they sort of bid to control courses. I mean, when I was studying my degree, actually some parts of Bradford University, there were courses which were sponsored by big business, mm-hmm. various sorts, you know, defence companies, that kind of thing. But that was very much a minority. There were only very few MAs and things like that, which were, nowadays it seems to be more and more happening that big companies, who of course are avoiding tax, many of them, they're actually deciding that rather than pay that money for education through the government and through Department of Education, that they can actually pay it direct to the university and pick and choose as to what courses and what curricula they impose. So tell us a bit about how the changes are being implemented up at Bristol University.
I mean, for example, are the root of all kind of problems or the stories about things that students are worried about at the moment are coming from dramatic rise in student numbers, and that the lack of regulation means that the university of now, I think we reported recently, in the last issue actually, that Bristol has risen in terms of student numbers the fastest of, I think, almost any university in the UK. But at the same time, there's been no rise in the amount of facilities for students. So for example, our library overcrowding is a huge issue that comes up every exam period, you know, even during the year. And at the same time, this is what the head of sport, director of sport, exercise and health, has used as his argument against the reinstating pay-as-you-go basis at all times. He's saying that now there are more students coming, the university won't give him more money to build more facilities. Sport has to be reserved for, you know, for people who want to do it seriously, or at least they have to be prioritised and other people effectively priced out of it. I mean, the point I'd make is that university is a public good. Society benefits from more people going to university. The same with sport. Society benefits from more people doing exercise. You know, there'd be less if everyone did a certain amount of exercise and felt able to. Our health bodies would have a bit less to do. So the point I'd make is that there's no consultation between students and university, or even the university and the students' union, over things like this, and nor is it coordinated with policies from local government with regards to things like housing. There's not an increase in housing at all to match this the dramatic rise in student numbers. For instance, start of this year, about 50 students or maybe 40 were housed in the university's our veterinary campus in Langford, which is about 20 miles from the university, because there was no accommodation, university owned or private accommodation, available for them. So students are losing out from the simple fact that what the university is doing is not in consultation with government, local or national, is not in consultation with the students' union, and is not coordinate, if not reflected by an increase in facilities, whether it be sports facilities, whether it be housing, whether it be library space.
Now, you mentioned housing. Another story you have here is residents have been meeting, residents in Cottam and Redland. Now, this is something that I can remember from living in Oxford. There was all sorts of problems with the sort of infantilisation, because lots of students come in and they're silly on a Friday night, particularly, and Saturday night, they get drunk. They sort of walk on top of cars and do silly stuff, stand in the middle of the road, you know, to stop the cars going by. Now, this is obviously annoying people. I'm not sure if it's exactly these things that are happening in Cottam and Redland. But, I mean, how do you make sure that the students actually do integrate properly with the city and aren't seen as a kind of bunch of naughty boys and girls?
It's really difficult, because in these areas you mentioned, Cottam and Redland, they're so overpopulated by students. I mean, the residents would say 70 to 80% even at times of roads can be students. So local residents feel that, you know, they're being swamped, to coin a phrase, by students. And to be honest, There are several different bodies who have a role to play in improving working on student community relations. Local council Antony Negus was at the meeting, and he and representative from the student union have both said that it should be a combination of the university taking a bit of responsibility for where students are living, improving community relations, which, to be fair, they have done with a new fund called a community fund, which allows residents associations money at the start of each year to organise welcome meals and stuff, so students can meet local residents. And this is, you know, the start and a good start. But also you have increasing number of private rentals, and you have landlords who, where a student will only be there for 1 year, most of the time, maybe 2 years in the same property, landlords who will own a property for a lot longer, and letting agencies are charging students extortionate fees, and it's an unrelated issue, are taking no responsibility for any of this, and it's all being left to students and the residents themselves. And the residents naturally, you know, will remember the bad experiences they have with students more than the good, or at least will voice them. So at meetings like this one, which a representative from the student union went to, will naturally voice the problems they've had and the anecdotal, you know, the anecdotes kind of things you've mentioned, maybe changed a tiny bit, but that sort of thing, which sadly they will remember, and they won't notice as strikingly the time when students actually do good things in their communities or do help out a little bit, you know. So it's a really difficult process, but everyone has a part to play in it. Students themselves, residents to make a bit of an effort, because I've seen a Facebook group recently where residents, you know, they set it up to say they're going to, you know, have discussions with students and work together, but really it's become a forum for residents to rant about this student last night did this and doesn't.
Well, fair play. I mean, because, I mean, obviously, you know, if it's keeping them awake, then they've got every right to do that. But look, what about the ultimate here, which is, you know, you as students are looking at the system, you know, you were promised by the Lib Dems before the last general election to get rid of tuition fees. Now, you know, it's impossible really to be studying without starting to rack up large amounts of debt, unless you've got some sort of privileged access to well-paid part-time job, in which case, you know, you may not be racking up debt, but most students are. How do you fix the economic nightmare?
How do you fix the economic nightmare? I mean, not sure how much.
That's a biggie.
It shouldn't be students paying for the economic crisis, which is caused by bankers. You know, students. I mean. You wouldn't be surprised here. There's no Lib Dem society anymore at the university since the announcement on tuition fees. But there is a disconnect between students and mainstream political parties. I don't think that you'll find many students at all, even at Bristol, which is, you know, which does, in terms of percentages, does have 40% private schooled compared to 7% of the population. I don't think you'll find many students who think that it's a fair amount, the amount students are having to pay every year, and that's without mentioning the rocketing costs in accommodation, even with the very poor quality of housing that students experience, you know, and with, I mean, students are under attack, and are young people more generally, sorry, with things like scrapping of EMA, which is equally bad, more than almost anyone else in society.
That's the educational maintenance allowance, yeah?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, well, just to point us towards whereabouts people can find, if they can't get a hold of your copy of your newspaper up at the University Student Union, just buy 20th Century Flix. That's the way I like to say it. That's one of my landmarks in the city. If you just go near to 20th Century Flix up near on the way to Clifton, just into Clifton, the student union's on the left. Whereabouts can we find you online?
Yeah, I just go to www.epigram.org.uk, the homepage of our site, and from there you'll find all the individual sections. So I mean, I'm from the news section, and we've been talking about news stories, but you'll also find music reviews, film reviews, you know, what's going on in Bristol, arts events, etc. You'll find something.
Okay, Zaki Dogliani, deputy editor of Epigram and editor of the news section, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thanks for having me.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
And finally, this week, to the old chestnut of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Well, not possibly not finally, because we're trying to get Steve Jolly up in Birmingham, but the Israeli state's claim to the land of Palestine is based on the Jews' historical connection to the land. But, as many point out, most of the Eastern European Jews who came to Palestine after World War II are actually descended from peoples who converted to Judaism hundreds of years ago. Whilst they are religiously Jewish, they're not necessarily the same dark-skinned Semitic peoples who were originally banished from the Holy Land. Well, this may seem pedantic to some, but it's just one of the myths about the supposed biblical reasons why some believe are misinterpretations of history, a misinterpretation of the Bible and historical fact. If people believe strongly enough, that can become a myth and even lead to fundamentalism and fanaticism. Well, one Israeli's published a book recently on the Israelis' modern myths called The General's Son. Aptly titled, as he's son of one of Israel's highest-ranking military commanders in the 1967 Six-Day War. His name is Mikael Peled.
This whole issue of Israel and Palestine is covered in so much myth. There's so much double standard when people talk about this issue, and I'll give you two examples. I don't know if you heard Bibi Netanyahu's speech at the United Nations, and he began it with probably the two most striking examples of a myth and double standard. And he began by talking about the right of return of the Jews to their ancient homeland. And of course, the Jews that returned, so-called, to their homeland were not exactly the same Jews who were expelled from their homeland, right? Because these were expelled a couple of thousand years before that. These were not their descendants either, because this has been a very long time. So these are people, the people that actually came back, so to speak, are people that claim some kind of a heritage, some kind of a connection, a relationship to the ancient Hebrews. And they claimed that they had the right to return to their homeland, and this was what Zionism was about, and this was accepted by the world as the right. They had the right to return. Now, if we talk about the right of return of one nation, you'd expect that there would be, if we accept it as a principle, then you'd expect that we'd accept it in general, across the board. Yet when people talk about the right of return of Palestinians to their homeland, suddenly a red line comes up and everybody says, no, we can't talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. This has to be taken off the table. This is not negotiable. The right of return of the Palestinians is not acceptable. What's interesting about that is that the right of return of the Palestinians, we're talking about, quite often we talk about the actual people who had to leave their homes. And if they had already passed away, then we're talking about their direct descendants, people who still have the keys and the deeds to their homes, and quite often can go to the very spot where a village existed, where today there might be a highway, and will point out the mosque, and will point out the well, and will point out the door to their home. Yet they do not enjoy the right to return. So obviously, this is a double standard of immense proportions. The other thing Bibi talked about right off as he started was about King David, who reigned some 3,000 years ago, and here we are today as his descendants. What's interesting is, besides the fact that there is no historical evidence that King David ever existed outside the Bible, and Israeli archaeologists have all but turned up the entire country to find proof that he ever existed. Today, as we speak, an entire town, an entire community is being kicked out of their homes and forced into exile through violence in order to prove that King David existed in a place called Silwan. It's a community of 50,000 people right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. Yet the world sees nothing wrong with this. American money is poured into this project to build what is called the New City of David, an archaeological park. And a community of 50,000 Palestinians has to be terrorized in order to leave. Their homes are being destroyed in order to make this point. This fictional, mythical connection between the ancient kingdom of King David and today's Israel. So these are just two examples. And it was interesting that Bibi Netanyahu decided to kick off his speech at the United Nations with these two things. But what I'd like to do today is just begin with a little bit of history. People talk about the fact that this conflict, the conflict in the Holy Land, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has been around for so long that it's really not something anybody can ever solve. It's been going on for thousands of years. People have been killing each other there forever. This is not true. And a good place to start, if we're going to talk about how this conflict began, a good place to start would be on the 29th of November, 1947. The day that United Nations accepted the resolution to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And this ridiculous map is what they came up with. Now, when you look at this map, before you even hear about the details, before you even touch on the details of this map, just by looking at it, it's unbelievable that anybody expected that this would work. And of course, this didn't even last one day.
That's Miko Peled there, son of Israeli General Matthew Peled, Matiyahu Peled. And Miko was speaking about his new book, The General's Son. He finished there talking, Martin, about 1947 and the map, which was drawn up by the United Nations, of the separate states, the Jewish state and the Arab state. Now, this is a real mishmash, isn't it? Little pockets of Arab stuff, little pockets of Jewish stuff all over the place. Is he right there, do you think, in saying it was never really going to work?
Well, yeah, as he says, it only lasted one day.
It didn't even last a day, he said.
I think ultimately what's beginning to happen now because of the intransigence on the Israeli right is that people are starting to talk about a one-state solution, Israel-Palestine with a joint citizenship. And, of course, the progressive forces in Israel may decide if they get their head round it to form alliances with Arab-speaking Israeli citizens, because a substantial part of the Israeli electorate is in fact Arab speaking and they've got their own Arab political parties. And if they were to make common cause with the more progressive Israeli parties, then you could start to develop a one state politics on both sides of the green line, and that may be just a possibility of hope.
But what do you mean by the green line?
Well, in actual fact, the Israelis are not on the side of the line. What they were given in 1948, they seized a lot more then, and they seized a lot more in 1967. So if you're going to have a two-state solution, the Israelis have got to step back behind those lines. But maybe a two-state solution is no longer feasible, and we have to have a one-state solution with everybody with one citizenship. A possibility. But anyway, these things are resolvable if people have got the right attitude.
Okay, Martin. Ultimately, do you think there will be a one-state or a two-state solution? I mean, we had Alan Hart on here, the former BBC Panorama correspondent and also ITN Middle East correspondent, who was very familiar with it, and he said there won't be any solution.
I think more likely we're going to have a Middle East war that turns into a world war, but that's the sad reality.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Okay, finally this week, Steve Jolly joins me on the line, at least I hope. Steve, hi. You've come on this week particularly to talk about some changes to the regulations on CCTV, the Big Brother state. I mean, I'm worried about these technocrats. I think you've got a kind of technocratic elite, people that own a lot of this high-tech stuff, and they're keeping an eye on us. But at least there is some kind of regulation kicking in at the moment, isn't there?
Well, that's what we're supposed to think, you see. And I know you and I have discussed this before on your show. We talked about the Protection of Freedoms Act, and I gave evidence on that while it was a bill. I went down to Westminster and gave my views and opinions and facts and figures, and even waved some of their own previous policy documents at them about what was wrong with this the CCTV elements of the Protection of Freedoms Act, which is a complete Orwellian misnomer because it does no such thing. Within the Act, there is a code of practice to govern the use of CCTV. And as you say, most people would welcome regulation. They think, well, that's good because there'll be some checks and balances. And that's what we're supposed to think. So, and this is what the media reports. So everyone goes, yeah, fair enough. Okay, that's all fine. We don't want any surveillance being abused, or we want to know what's going on and that it's all been properly done by the book, as it were. And that's the impression that the public has got, and indeed that's the impression we're intended to have. And the wording of the Act itself keeps making reference to the need to keep up public support, to manufacture, if you like, public support for CCTV. And what's happened last week is that they finally released the code of practice in draft form. And they've said, this is our code of practice, this is how we will regulate CCTV, and it's supposedly being going through some sort of nominal consultation process. So they've given people 6 weeks to submit their thoughts and views and any objections to it, which is the minimum time available. So it's not really much of a consultation, but that, again, that is no surprise either.
So what's the major provisions of this, Steve? Because I'm worried particularly, I notice that you are too, on your website bigbrotherwatch.org.uk, about the drones. There's this new technology, isn't there, developed by the military. Drones have been created, which tell us something called the Argus, A-R-G-U-S, not Argos, Argus drone, which has got an incredible high-resolution camera. So these things can be flying around looking at everything that's going on in an entire city.
Yeah, I mean, it was a video released last week, and this is the project by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in America, working with BAE Systems, a big drone manufacturer, and they've unveiled this new super sensor that they fitted to drones. It's basically loads of really high-resolution military-grade cameras in the sort of a gigapixel range that can zoom in from 20,000 feet and almost read the newspaper over your shoulder, certainly make out the sort of logos on clothing or what you're wearing, and quite a lot of close-up detail. So it's sort of almost ground-level surveillance from 20,000 feet.
But what's the point of all this? I mean, should we be worried? I mean, it certainly just sounds a little bit weird. It's almost as if the government now see the population, the general domestic population, as some kind of enemy.
Well, I think they do. And this is becoming more and more apparent with the shifting definition of terrorism.
Anyway, Steve, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there because we're coming up to news time. But just to remind listeners, your website, bigbrotherwatch.org.uk.
It's no-cctv.org.uk.
Hey, I've noticed some of your stuff is getting onto that Big Brother Watch site anyway. So anyway, thanks very much for joining us. Time to sign off, but now, but that's just the start of your Friday night talk show, Radio Extravaganza. The typical topical Afro-tropical show is up next. Next week, Bristol Mayor candidate Tom Baldwin. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. I remind you, the BBC strike over compulsory redundancies starting at 8 a.m. outside White Ladies Road on Monday. This is Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
UK. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live
from the Sky News Centre at 7. Meals in hospitals, schools and pubs have been...